So you see, before the infection came in, the mind virus, which is what it is, this infection of salvationist religion, cultures all over the world, you know, the Native American Indians, China, Africa, Aborigines, they all knew that we were in the presence of some divine force. And they called her by many names. But basically, it's like, well, it's the Earth Mother. She's the divine mother. She gives us everything. She gives us corn, just animals, birds. You know, she is our mother. We are born from the Earth Mother. And what the Gnostics had, and what those who follow this revival today have, is a profound and intimate knowledge of that goddess figure.
I had a fascinating talk with John Lamblash about the Gnostic worldview. John Lamblash is arguably the heaviest authority on the Gnostics, at least on the Nag Hammadi Library. The Gnostics were vehemently opposed to the Abrahamic religions. One might think that's not so relevant in our secular world, but it is, because our secular society has inherited more features than we think from Abrahamic religions, which is something we talk a lot about in this episode. I've realized that there is a mainstream even in spirituality. Some of the things that John Lash says are controversial, and some of the Gnostic content, as John interprets it, is not entirely comfortable for me. Parts are outlandish, even by the standards of this channel. Maybe it's because what he says subliminally, deep within us, deep down, reminds us of something. Or not. At any rate, it's all incredibly fascinating by any stretch of that word. And as always, take what resonates and leave what doesn't. John says it very well in this episode himself. He says, don't believe me. If you care in your heart, if you feel that you can have some role in correcting the insanity of this world, then go and learn for yourself. The only authority is your own conscience. The core of the Gnostic message is to remember what is natural, to remember our deep connection with Gaia, with nature, and that we have all the faculties we need in our genome. Only you and I can know the truth about ourselves, truly. I should also say that the reason why John wears dark glasses in this conversation is that his eyes have become very sensitive to light. I hope you appreciate this episode. Welcome all. This is Mind the Shift. I'm Anders, and it's an honor and a pleasure to introduce you to John Lamblash, legendary mythologist in the footsteps of Joseph Campbell, visionary teacher and author. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have written a number of books. I don't know how many, 5, 6, 7 or something like that.
5 published, many others unpublished.
Okay. But is it fair to say that the book Not in His Image is the pivotal piece of work that you've done?
In a way, I would describe my work in its totality as an arrow. And Not in His Image is the head.
Okay.
The head, right? But the arrowhead is just the part of the arrow that penetrates the target. And then there is the entire arrow. And then there is the feathers and the vein, which are what steer the arrow. So I would say, yeah, it's the arrowhead of my work. But my work is an arrow.
Mm, beautiful. It's a foundation-shaking book. at least if you're mired in the Judeo-Christian tradition, if you're deeply mired in that, it's truly foundation shaking. I think it's foundation shaking for most people who Westerners who read it. Broadly, it reveals and explains what the Gnostics can teach us about who we are and what we have forgotten about life, which is wisdom that we arguably will need to survive going forward. And we'll dive deeply into this, hopefully, obviously. The Gnostic, let's begin with the term the Gnostics. It's a pretty generic term as far as I understand. So who were they, or perhaps are they?
Well, the first occurrence of the word Gnostic that scholars locate, which is a Greek word, gnostikos, meaning someone who knows, you know, which raises a big question. Well, what do they know? You know, what's so special about it? Is in Plato, in a philosophical context, when Plato describes them, and the passage seems to indicate that he used it to mean technicians of knowledge. Not just people who had a content of knowledge. For instance, they had a knowledge of a vast number of affairs in life, which they did, because they taught the humanities, they taught literature, astronomy, music. They were the great teachers of the pre-Christian world. But also there's a nuance, and that nuance is extremely important. So a Gnostic, by my definition, which would be true to their legacy, true to the way they saw themselves. Okay, we have to talk about them as they saw themselves, because they have been slandered and vilified and repressed for centuries. So I talk about the straw man argument about the Gnostics. They have a bad name today, but that's only because of the straw man argument. So everyone who comes to my work will have to get past that straw man argument. I try to take you past it to an actual, accurate definition of what the Gnostics were in their time and what you can be today if you choose to be a Gnostic. So basically, it means someone who knows things. And I would say, I would expand that to mean, first of all, they know how they know. You know, we call that in modern terms, epistemology. So epistemology is a big name for the study of how we know what we know, okay? But to put it in layman's terms, it simply means, well, you know how the mind works. Your mind is a tool. It is designed to work in a certain manner. And if you know how your mind works, then you can use it to its highest capacity. So I translate that into the expression noetics. Now, noetics and noetic psychology is a recent science by definition of history, but it's not recent at all. They were the first noetic cognitive psychologists. And so I try to recapture their legacy, what they truly were. And I try to bring it forward and upscale it and make it something that we can use today. So that's why I call it applied noetics. And I prefer to use that term, because the term Gnostic has been very sullied, and it has a really bad reputation that it doesn't deserve, actually.
Yeah, well, maybe it has gotten better lately, because many people who are into the spiritual community and the New Age and all that, they have started to talk about the Gnostics in a very positive way, haven't they? I mean, compared to 50, 60, 70 years ago, I don't know.
No. The only people who talk about the Gnostics in a positive way, as far as I know, are those who have read my book and follow my interpretation, if you want to call that. I have an interpretation of the Gnostics that stands apart from all the other talk about them. As far as New Age spirituality and things of that sort, well, I don't know, it's been 15, 16 years since Not in His Image came out. And I don't find that people who declare themselves spiritual, it's a word I don't use, by the way, or who declare themselves New Age are really finding the true message of Gnosticism. They're lost in the sauce, most of them, if you know that expression.
Mm.
Lost in the sauce.
Yeah, I kind of understand that expression. So let's talk about their legacy and their wisdom and what you tell about it in your book, and how you know what you know, how you've come across what you know, because there was a pivotal event. As you say, they had been repressed for centuries and centuries and slaughtered on a mass scale by the Catholic Church and others also, perhaps. They were mainly active in the region of the Levant and the Mediterranean. And as far as I understand, you can correct me on that one, but there was a pivotal event back in December of 1945 when there was a discovery in a village called Nag Hammadi in Egypt. Can you tell us about that and what that has entailed?
Sure. In first week of December 1945, an Arab peasant was hunting around in caves for something like bat guano or fertilizer. It's a very arid region. And he found these jars, clay jars, and in them were these books called the Nag Hammadi Codexes. So codex just means book. But the reason why they're called books is very significant, because they are the earliest surviving example of actually bound books. They are leather-bound books, like we have today. Previously, there were only papyrus leaves, you know, papyrus scrolls. So they are the oldest example. And they date the books themselves as physical artifacts, date to about 325 AD, okay? But the material that they contain, that's another question. Where does it come from? What were the original versions? It appears that most of the material in the Nag Hammadi Codices is just like stenographic copies of other materials. So what were the original materials, you know? And so there's a lot of questions about the origins of that material. But that came forth, and it wasn't until sometime later that a scholar named Jean Duress found them, or he was shown them in Cairo in a library, and he said, you know, holy moly, do you realize what this is? This is the only surviving documents we have that we can actually attribute to this mysterious group of people called the Gnostics. So it was a huge breakthrough. They're not the only ones. There are some non-Nag Hammadi texts that are important too, but it's the main body upon which I have reconstructed the message of Gnosticism.
Yeah, and it's huge, but it's actually the material isn't that huge. It's 52 books or something, isn't it? I mean the body of text is not as big as, for instance, your book that you've written.
No, how much is it? 52 texts, some very fragmentary, some very short, some quite long, all very confusing. It's a huge muddle. It's only about 30 of them that are worth consideration. And on my website, Nemata, there's a course called Gnosis Today, in which I've written commentaries on those 30 that I consider to be of importance. Mm-hmm. It's a huge job of reconstruction that I went through to pull them together. I have to use these things here. You see this?
Yeah, the Coptic Gnostic Library.
This is actually the scholarly edition. So you can see that it has Coptic and English. So it was published in English in 1976. It's called the Nag Hammadi Library in English. And it's just, it's gibberish. It's really almost impossible to make any sense out of it. So you really have to go and dig into the source materials, which is what I did. So one of my objectives, in Not in His Image, basically the first quarter of the book is dedicated to the problem we're facing still today. And it traces back that problem all the way to about 2000 BC. And it is the problem, and I don't know if anyone will be surprised by me saying this, but what I found that the basic core problem that underlies all the other problems in our world today is an ideology of master race supremacy. Of course, it's common knowledge that this concept of master race was connected with the German people in the 20th century. Mm-mm, wrong. It goes way back before that. And as a matter of fact, the ideology of that movement in the 20th century is not at all similar to the master race ideology, which I have exposed in Notton's image. Not at all similar. So this is a dangerous subject. It goes very deep into the wounding of civilization and the wounding of our very sense of humanity. So in the first quarter of the book, I describe the problem. I go to the root of evil, which is not a cosmic force. There's no cosmic evil. There's no battle between cosmic good and cosmic evil. In my opinion, I find no evidence of that. But the battle between good and evil is right here. It's in the human heart and in our minds, you see? So I expose the problem, and I think I've done that in a way that no one else has done. I can't tell you how many people have written me and said, wow, your book was the single thing that I ever found that completely blew me out of my religious indoctrination. You know, so I talk about religious ideology. I talk about the Savior, the male creator God who is off planet, the Savior, the Messiah, and the apocalypse, the last judgment. And I explain that the Gnostics saw all of that as insanity. Mm. I would really call it religious insanity. And by the way, I want to point out, we may get back to this, that this program, which is called the program of Zadik, Zaddik, that is the operative term. Zadik means ultra righteous. If I am Zadik, if I entitle myself as Zadik, it means I am ultra righteous. I am holier than you, and I have the authority to tell you how you must live. Right? That is the Zadik. That is the core of this.
Sounds familiar if you know something about traditional religion.
Well, all the Abrahamic religions are based on Zadik.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. In the study of deep human history, I think it's sad that conventional scholars often don't take ancient texts seriously, but you do, and you do it to a T. I mean, you have not you not just try to explain what happened to humanity long time ago, but you explain the source of human suffering as you are talking about here, and you expose the what I interpret as the huge misunderstanding of human life that is embedded in the Abrahamic religions. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So what is it that we have misunderstood or misconstrued for millennia without realizing it? You talk about the Redeemer complex, for instance. Can you explain that?
This Zadik impulse, you can call it, this Zadik factor, which emerged over many centuries. It goes back to about 1800. It goes back to an incident. It's actually described in the Bible. You know, in the Genesis. So there's a story in there about the meeting between Abraham, who is the founder of all the Abrahamic religions, including Islam, because he had a son with his consort Hagar, and that son, Ishmael, is the progenitor of the Arabic peoples, right? Whereas Isaac is the progenitor of the Jewish peoples. So Jews and Arabs are really just the same race, really. They're cousins, you know. But in that scene, he meets Melchizedek, and Melchizedek is, as it were, the iconic figure that represents how this alien and insane ideology came into our world, right? So I explain all that, as you say, in meticulous detail, which other scholars don't. They for some reason, they don't. Well, they're Judeo-Christian scholars. Mm. So they have a vested interest in preserving their belief system, but I don't, because I'm a heretic. And I'm out to completely destroy their belief system and to liberate people from it to the best of my ability. So yeah, there are several components of this Zadok factor. One is that there is a sole supreme creator God who is male, and he is external to the world. I call him the off-planet father God. Then there is the Messiah or the Savior, who is in a way sent by the Father God. Then there is the trial and the judgment of humanity. Do you or do you not obey the laws of the ultra righteous who tell you how to live? Right? By the way, I want to add, in case we skip over it, that the ultra righteous today among us are in the field of technocracy. For instance, if you see this guy called Harari, get his full name, Harari. He's an Israeli.
Yeah. Historian.
He wrote this book called Homo Deus.
Yeah. I read that one.
All right. When you see Harari, who's like one, we could name maybe 10 people who are at the top of the pyramid of technocracy, right? The technocratic elite, right? That is the Zadok today. The transhumanism is the result of Zadok today. And of course, those people stand up there like experts, and they think that they're going to tell you how, not only how you can live, but how you must live.
Yeah, I was thinking of coming back to that, actually, that kind of question, if we have time. So
so we'll come back to that later.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to point out that there's a long arc, and it comes down to today. I'm not talking about ancient history here.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about reviving a dead religion. I'm talking about the urgent and imperative need to face evil. And transhumanism is evil, no matter how you play it, no matter how you spin it. So what happened was, and the Gnostics detected all this, is that when this religious ideology came over many centuries, developed first in Judaism, then it came into Christianity, right? The goal of it is actually to destroy our inherent sense of what it is to be human. That's why the WEF, that's why Schwab can say, we are going to change what it means to be human. You've heard that.
Mm-hmm. You believe it's a conspiracy. You think it's a conspiracy theory, but he actually says those things.
Yeah, of course he does. Yeah. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy analyst.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah.
So he says that, and then Harari, standing there talking about the future of AI and how AI and chat GPT and everything, the world is going to change and you're going to have to go along with it whether you like it or not. And Harari uses the word we, like as if he's speaking for humanity, but he's not. He's only speaking for his in-group, which is this movement. And so I track that movement. That's all about the problem. And I track that in the first quarter of the book. I talk about who St. Paul was and the Melchizedek connection. I don't think anyone else describes the Melchizedek connection quite the same way that I do. But then in the other three quarters of the book, I talk about the solution. So, yeah, it's important to understand who hated the Gnostics and who tried to wipe them out. Destroyed the libraries of antiquity, destroyed the sacred writings of their schools and their networks. It's important to know that, but it's much more important to know that they had a message for humanity that is a solution to those problems. And so the greater part of the book is about the mysteries because the mysteries were the schools run by Gnostics in which they taught, who, you know, let's go to your three questions. What are the three questions that you, short questions that you have in your email you sent to me? Like,
who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going?
Okay. And there's a third one, I think. What is our purpose of being here?
Mm-hmm.
The answer to those questions is in my book. And you might say, well, John, you know, so Lash, John Lash, who are you? You know, you just have another answer. Is it any better than the other answers that we get from science, religion, or philosophy, or the New Age? Well, I can't tell you it's better. You have to find that out for yourself. It's certainly better for me and for the people in my life who have found this Gnostic message. And also, I would say that as a Gnostic, as a representative of the Gnostics today, the way I can answer those three questions may not be better, but it certainly is different. It's completely different from any answer that you will get from science, religion, philosophy, or the New Age.
Hmm. Well, New Age is a very generic term, to be sure.
Yeah. So
it contains all kinds of things. And what the Gnostics pointed out when Christianity arose and Judaism was already there was that this Redeemer complex, this idea that there is a Redeemer, there's redemption to come if you only follow the rules, and the separation between God and humans, that, as you say, the God is an off-planet thing. It's an entity that is not here, but we have to obey it. And if we we follow the rules, we will come to the right place when we die. Otherwise, we go to the other place. Or, I mean, all those kinds of ideas that are dangerous. They pointed out that this is wrong and this is dangerous, and they were hated for it, and they were persecuted for it, of course.
Well, of course, they were heretics, and yeah. I'm a heretic. You know, the word heretic simply comes from a Greek verb, herein, which means to choose. So if you're a heretic, it means you choose what you believe.
Mm.
It means you don't grow up just accepting what your parents or your culture taught you to believe.
Mm.
You choose it by your free will, right?
Sounds like the way to go. We should all be heretics.
Heresy is coming back, I think. One of the primary, the heart of the whole Gnostic message is, you can hear it on a 4-minute, 30-second video on YouTube. If you go to sophianicmyth.org on YouTube, or Sophianic Myth, there's an introduction to the Fallen Goddess scenario. So the Fallen Goddess scenario is what I restore in the remaining three-quarter of the books. It's a great narrative that answers the three questions, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that the Fallen Goddess scenario teaches you is that, well, religion might have told you that that there's God. Where do you get your idea of God from? Who told you who God is? Who told you who humanity is? You know, everyone listening to me now can admit in full humility that you didn't invent those ideas yourself. You got them from somewhere. Well, you can get from the Gnostic teachings a different answer to what God is or goddess, you see? So what they said was, no, it's wrong. It's what you call God is really a pretender God. It's a demented alien. I mean, this is the most outrageous statement that has ever been made in the history of religion. And it's largely for saying that they were hunted down and driven into exile. Yeah, your God, what you think is God, the Heavenly Father, is actually a demented alien. Who pretends to be God, only pretends to be.
Mm.
Like Klaus Schwab. He's a demented alien who pretends to be, what, the overlord of the world, right? It's the same thing. And they said, okay, we're not only going to tell you that that God that you feel so devoted to and you want to follow his rules is not the true God. Well, we'll tell you who is, right? This is who is. Yes? You know what that is?
No, not really. Tell me.
It's called a corn dolly. A corn dolly, that is in people in when they gathered corn or wheat in the field, they made it into a stack and they tied it, right? And then they came and they gathered the stack. And those stacks of wheat or corn are called dollies. And so this is, I think, from the Zuni Indians of New Mexico. And so they made a fetish of the corn dolly, right? This is a beautiful fetish. You see the face of it and everything. See that? It's carved in some kind of white stone. I'm not sure what it is. And this represents the white goddess. This is a fetish of the white goddess. It was recognized by many, many people. So you see, before the infection came in, the mind virus, which is what it is, this infection of salvationist religion, cultures all over the world, you know, the Native American Indians, China, Africa, Aborigines, they all knew that we were in the presence of some divine force. And they called her by many names. But basically, it's like, well, it's the Earth Mother. She's the divine mother. She gives us everything. She gives us corn, just animals, birds. You know, she is our mother. We are born from the Earth Mother. And what the Gnostics had and what those who follow this revival today have is a profound and intimate knowledge of that goddess figure, that she is present. The off-planet Father God is not present. He's invisible. You can't see him. You can't touch him. You can't taste him. You can't smell him. But you can see, touch, taste, and smell that goddess, because it is the living earth. So the whole core of the Gnostic message is to bring humanity back to the presence of this goddess figure who is called Sophia, meaning wisdom. That's the whole point of everything that I do.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And in this Gnostic myth of life, the goddess of wisdom, as you say, Sophia or Sophia, dreams up humanity, as far as I understand, in a way, dreams up humanity, emanates from the galactic core and becomes Earth. But in the process, there is a side species with negative influence on humans that is created as well, which are called the Archons. So how should we understand this, the Archon influence? Should it be understood as something concrete, or is it more metaphorical? Like, for instance, our shadow in the psyche, like the left brain having hijacked the right brain, as you know, Ian McGilchrist talks about in a book, for instance. Or how should this be understood?
Well, it's a big question. And I know that people do struggle with this factor of the Archons. But I would advise first, before I give you my latest pitch on the Archons, right? I would just advise this. I introduced the word Archon myself into discourse on the internet in 2002, 20 years ago. And since that time, I have always used it rigorously in the framework of this narrative, which is the biography of the wisdom goddess, where she originated, how she created humanity. She is the designer of the human species and so forth. And I have always spoke about the Archons in that framework, in the framework of that story. Because if you go outside the framework of that story, if you don't have it as a guiding paradigm, then there's a tendency to speculate about all kinds of things about the Archons, which to my mind is a waste of time. Mm-hmm. So I would say this. No, it's not about projection or your shadow. By the way, I entirely reject the Jungian concept of projection and the shadow entirely. It is not about right brain, left brain. It is about an actual paranormal influence upon our world. A paranormal influence that comes from outside of the atmosphere. And the archons are a species, like a cyborg insect type species, that were generated by accident. So why are they even here in this? Why do they impinge upon this world? They're not here in this world because they can't live in the biosphere. They cannot live in the biosphere because oxygen is toxic to them. So, but they can try to break in. So a big part of the story, the fallen goddess scenario, is, okay, how did the archons appear in the first place? And why are they messing with us? And how do they get into our minds? It's a mind virus. I'm not talking about the invasion of little green men or reptilians crawling out of holes in the earth. That's fantasy material. I'm talking about something more serious than that, which is a virus in the mind, a mind virus that is carried, and then it raises the question, well, how did humanity get infected with this mind virus? You know, so the answer to all of those questions would be far too much for us to talk about here at length, okay? But you only find the answer by going to the narrative with a desire to learn. You have to learn this. I can't just spoon feed it to you. There has to be a very strong will to learn. And where does that will to learn come from? It comes from the love for that goddess figure, the love for the earth, and also the love for her species, because she was a designer. She designed the human genome, and I talk a lot about that, the human genome, which the Gnostics call the Anthropos. So the whole story of how we got here, the answer to your three questions, is in the Gnostic material as I've brought it forth today. Some of it I found in the original material after raking through it hundreds of times. And some of it I've elaborated and developed to bring it up to our time so that it, you know, it meets our needs today.
So when do I encounter archon influence in my daily life or in your daily life and everybody's daily life? When I feel worried, when I feel afraid, when I'm scared that something bad is going to happen, when I've no. Want to protect myself? Is that kind of the mind influence that you're talking about?
No. When I use the word paranormal, I realize it's a very big term and it doesn't really say much of anything. You know, it's what we would call an umbrella term. But let me see if I can clarify it in this way. There is a category of diverse paranormal events that can occur. Like a lucid dream is a paranormal event. Various psychic phenomenon, okay? There's a wide range of diverse psychic phenomena that human animals typically experience. I think everybody's had them. And they are not our contact. They are simply phenomena that arise in human emotion and imagination because we don't know how to operate our own operating system correctly. You see? Mm-hmm. You could say that if you put someone in a car who doesn't know how to drive, they don't know how to control the wheel, the brakes, the accelerator, the clutch. And so they start driving in the car and the car starts shaking or it goes off the road or it stalls. That's what psychic phenomena are. They are simply malfunctions of the natural operations of the human psyche. However, there is one exception. There is one type of paranormal event that is archontic and that can be traced back to the archons. Okay? So if that is correct, what I'm saying, okay, then it begs the question, well, how do we detect it? How do we know that that specifically is archontic? I'll give you the quickest rundown that I can. The archontic intrusion upon humanity in the biosphere has morphed over the ages. Okay, it has changed. The first form of archontic intrusion, which still persists today, is in salvationist religion. They intruded by infecting the human mind with an alien ideology. So if you ask me, well, where do you encounter the archons today? Go into a church. There you'll find their influence. When you see that tortured man on the cross, that is an archontic imprint in your mind. Where you see the hierarchy and the pomp of the Catholic Church, that's archontic. Same thing with Buddhists, by the way. Dalai Lama and all the rope, that's all very archontic. So wherever you see a religious or spiritual ideology that is directed by some higher authority than you, you're looking the archontic intrusion right in the face.
So it's more like ideas that have been introduced into our minds.
What's a mind virus? And what do you have in your mind? Ideas. So you have some ideas in your mind that are healthy, like you have some chemicals in your body that are healthy, and you have some things that are in your body that are unhealthy if you eat badly or you get an infection. It's an infection in the mind, and it operated first through religious ideology, okay? But then over centuries, it mutated. It's a mutating virus. And if we want to look at the way that you encounter the archons today, the archonic influence, I said it before.
You mentioned two names there, yeah?
Yeah, transhumanism. All of this insane hype and fear-mongering, scare tactics. Oh, AI. Oh, AI, you know? The archontic influence is AI. AI is archontic intelligence. AI is alien intelligence. It is not artificial intelligence because there is no such thing as artificial intelligence, because intelligence is alive. True intelligence is alive. Yeah. And AI is not alive. It will never be alive. It will never have agency. It will never achieve singularity. And it will never take over your life unless you surrender to it. So we're at the front line of the archonic attack right now in this attempt to convince people by fear and threats, right? Oh, it's coming, AI, it's the end of humanity. This is the archonic force coming right at you. It's not something mysterious. And so you might ask, well, John, how can you say that that is paranormal? Isn't that just an expression of science and the human mind? You know, hasn't science and technology just evolved to this point? You know, how can you say there's something paranormal in it, something alien? The answer to that is that if you use your common sense and you look at it without fear, you can see that it is insane. It's insane. And the insanity is something beyond human. There's a point that I make very often, and I'm not very sure that I get this point across to people. It may be one of the more difficult points I make. But, you know, are you concerned about evil and evil in the world? Do you think there's real evil in the world? People with evil intention? You think there are people who want to harm others and cause them suffering and deprive them of the freedom to live and all that? Okay, so you care about the problem, right? You want to understand. How can certain people would be so evil, right? Maybe you've asked that question. I guarantee you that you cannot see to the ultimate source of evil, human evil, unless you see there is a non-human factor in it. And this is a test for everyone. This is a test for your probity, you know, your ability to investigate something. But I assure you, that is one of the greatest lessons that I have drawn. And if we did not have this archontic presence in this world, by the way, it's dying out. It's in its dying phase. I could talk a lot about that.
Yeah, let's come back to that. Yeah.
Yeah. If we did not have it in what I call the divine experiment, okay, so I call life on Earth in the biosphere with the human species, plants, trees, ocean, water, insects, snakes. It's a great experiment. It's a biological laboratory created by divine beings with love and a sense of mischief and adventure, right? They don't know the outcome of this experiment. They just put us in it. They gave us certain abilities and capacities. And they said, okay, now let's watch this species. And let's watch how they all interact. With, you know, it's a wonderful, thrilling adventure. If we did not have the archontic intrusion, then there would be wars. There would be conflicts. There would be some measure of cruelty. There would be some measure of inflicted suffering, that is to say, intentional suffering inflicted upon others, right? There would be those phenomena would happen in human behavior, but they would be nothing on the scale of what we see today. It's the scale of it that tells you that it is, that there's something non-human in it. See, and this is not easy to grasp. I'm explaining it for the 100th time the best I can. It's just something that you can't be told about it. I'm telling you, but you're not going to get it just from me telling you.
No, you have to feel, you have to kind of sense that it is, as you say, insane, and it doesn't make sense when you sit with it for a while.
Yeah, it's insane and inhumane.
It's inhumane.
Inhumane.
That's the term that we use even for the wars and the atrocities that are going on. We use the term.
Yeah, but war in itself, the conflict between different races or ethnic groups, is not insane. It's not. It's always happened because there are two components in this experiment. One is cooperation or mutual aid, and the other is competition. And it's natural. People who think, people who dream, people who want to say, oh, if we could only live in a world where there's no conflict, are very naive. But the way the conflict develops, it can develop in human terms, or it can develop into an inhumane scale of insanity, which is what those wars were about.
Well, sure. I mean, there are many tiers, layers of conflict. It doesn't have to go to as far as war, of course. I mean, you can have conflicts without having wars.
Yeah, that's right. And you can have tribal wars, and there have always been tribal wars, and there have always been territorial wars. It's in the nature of the experiment.
Well, an argument at a workplace is a kind of a conflict.
Yeah, marriage is a conflict.
It's a conflict. Yeah. So, was the just to see here what has happened and why, according to the Gnostic story here, the Gnostic wisdom, if you will, was the emergence of this salvationist religion thing, this redeemer complex, was that the human mistake, or is it salient to you and to us who read your book because it's close to our current culture and it's also near our written history? Or, I mean, because, I mean, humanity has been around for hundreds of thousands of years, probably, maybe millions. So this is pretty close in history. Was it really the mistake, or was this bad influence there already earlier? Or, I mean,
no, it was not there.
Let you answer this question.
No, it was not there. I explained how it got here. You know, there's a great saying from one of the Gnostic books that says, whoever does not know the origin of evil is no stranger to it. Now, that's a very high standard of knowledge. What is that saying to you, people who are listening to me now, whoever you may be, whatever, what age? It says that if you cannot know and see with certainty what the origin of evil behavior is, then you may be accessory to it without knowing that you are. You may go along with it. I mean, how many good people who would never harm anyone go along with Christianity? They don't have to. What do they think, that they have to believe in a child sacrifice, which, by the way, is the basis of Judeo-Christianity, as I say in my book? Child sacrifice. Abraham sacrifices his son. The Father God sacrifices his son, who is the most perfect and innocent child that ever lived. What are you looking at there? You want to go along with that?
And that's the one blind spot, even for atheists and church haters.
Yeah. Christ. Yeah. So this is deep stuff, but it all comes down to how the Gnostic message hits you. You know, how is what I'm saying now to you listening? How's it hitting you? Where is it hitting you? It has to hit you right here in the conscience of your heart. And it has to hit you here because it takes common sense and lucidity to work these things out. That is the challenge. And that's how we get out of this current situation, and we defeat the archontic transhumanist agenda. Mm. That is the great test.
Why did they wait for hundreds of thousands of years before they intruded into the human mind?
Very good question. First of all, there are a lot of fail-safes in this experiment. The human genome, when it was designed in the galactic core, in the fallen goddess scenario, explains that. It was sealed. It was sealed for protection. And I described exactly how the sealing occurs. It's done with what's called exclusion water, which is the fourth state of water.
Yeah, it's like more gel kind of like.
Yeah, state. It's like a gel. It's encapsulated in a gel. This is the human genome. And so there is a lot of chatter going around about, coming from Zachariah Sitchin and other disinformation agents, that the Archons or Anunnaki or some alien civilization hacked into the human genome. No, they did not. They cannot hack into the human genome. It's impossible. And the atmosphere, so there are two things that protect us. One is the genome is protected, your genome in your body. And the other is that the biosphere of the Earth repels them, cannot live in their physical form, which is like a insect locust like creature. They exist in the outer solar system. The myth says that the Archons do not exist in the universe at large. They do not come from an advanced civilization. They exist uniquely in our solar system as an abnormal species that the goddess herself produced by accident. This is very big stuff for people to swallow.
I know. If you never heard about it before, it sounds crazy, but yeah.
It's very coherent, believe me. And the more you look at it, the more sense it makes. So no, they can't penetrate into the atmosphere, but what they do is they use shortwave frequency transmissions. And the nature of the Archon beings, the Archon entities, is that they are a mimetic species. So they cannot do anything except replicate or imitate. So they observe the Earth from the surrounding solar system, okay, from the other planetary bodies, particularly Saturn, for many, many thousands of years. And the Gnostics say that they became envious. They use this word. They were envious. They were able to observe our experiment. How did they do it? They did it by shortwave scanning. They didn't actually do it because they have eyes like us to see, because they are not organic. They do not have eyes. Okay? They have sensors behind those big bulging eyes, right? They have sensors. And so they tracked and scanned for a long time, and they wanted to be like us. This is what the story says, you know? And then they realized, well, we can't be like them because they're superior to us. And we were just an accident. We're a cosmic accident. They are the result of a divine imagination of the aeons in the cosmic center, you know, and they are higher than us, and they think they're more intelligent than us. It says this in these books, you know. It says, I quote, yeah, the Archons realized that the Anthropos was more intelligent, more beautiful. It's free. It can play. And so they their envy turned bad, and they said, well, if we can't be like them, maybe we can get them to be like us. Maybe we can turn them into mindless drones and zombies. And so they tried and they tried. There was like a barrage of this shortwave frequency blasting into the atmosphere for many, many millennia before they finally broke through. In order to break into the experiment, they had to go through a particular vector, and they neurologically infected that vector, and then that vector spread their virus, let's say. That's how the story goes. It's an enormous story, you know?
It doesn't matter. I mean, people can draw their conclusions themselves, or
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and take you, believe what you're saying, or think that you're talking baloney. I mean, it's
don't believe me.
It's a free world.
don't believe me.
Yeah.
Don't believe me. Hmm. If you really care in your heart, if you really feel that you can have some role as a sovereign individual in correcting the perverted insanity of this world, then go and learn how to do it. And everything I talk about is provable. And people who follow my work, I don't know what their numbers are, but every one of them who follows this updated Gnosticism will tell you, yeah, we can prove it. We live it. We are part of the solution. We are part of what is called in this text, Sophia's correction. The correction of the insane behavior of humanity is happening. And Gnostics today dedicate themselves to that correction, which is a great theme in the thing, and there's even a chapter, I think. Yeah, there's a chapter that's called Sophia's Correction.
There is in your book.
Chapter 22.
So the Gnostic message is a unique message. It's not a version of ancient truth that's been conveyed for tens of thousands of years. I mean, the Hermetic text, the Vedic text, the Sumerian text, the Mayan texts. It's something different, is it?
Yeah, it's the only, to my knowledge, the only complete and coherent explanation of your three questions. How did we originate? What are we doing here? You know, and where do we go from here? You can go to, you know, 1,000 scientists. You can go to 1,000 religious leaders. You can go to 1,000 philosophers and ask them those questions, right? And they will all give you answers, and maybe you'll like those answers better than mine. But I can only assure you of one thing, that the answer that I'm telling you is completely different.
Yeah.
Any answer they will give you.
As far as I see, can understand now, the difference is maybe that the Gnostic texts are talking about specifically humankind and humanity and how everything went awry for humanity and what happened and how humanity was created and all that. And also the earth, of course, because we're an integral part of earth and earth is Sophia. But other spiritual texts, or, I mean, you don't use the word spiritual, but other ancient texts, ancient wisdom texts, they speak perhaps more about how the universe works, what is beneath the physical reality and all that, like the Hermetic principles. The Hermetic texts talk about that. They don't talk specifically about humanity and how humanity came about. But is this a correct interpretation of the difference between the Gnostic texts and the others?
Well, you'll find in my book here in the footnotes, and you also find extensively in my other writings and my school, Nemeta, that I have drawn over, well, let's say, let me calculate how old I am. I hope I don't fall into a coma. You think, okay, let's say 55 years at least. You know, I've studied Vedic philosophy, Zen. I've studied all of the philosophical systems in the world and tried to practice them, tried to see how to apply them to life. And you'll see in my work that there are certain overlaps. The main overlap that I make is between the Gnostic message and what is called Hindu Tantra Vidya. Hindu Tantra, not Buddhist Tantra, although I do rip off a lot from Buddhist Tantra too. I'm kind of like a thief. I go and I steal things from these other systems, you know, if they work. I steal parts of their cars, you know, to build my model car, right? I draw very deeply on this Hindu Tantra. And there's a great saying, which is from the Visvasara Tantra. And it says, what is here is there. What is not here is nowhere.
Now, I remember that from the book. Yeah.
And so I hold by that. You want to know about other dimensions and, you know, where all the cosmic structure and everything and what's all behind this? And well, I teach about that too. It's called the Parinama, or the mechanism of cosmic projection. But one of the requirements I make upon those who are interested in learning about that is that, look, I can tell you about the dimensional structure of the universe, that there are 10 dimensions. I can tell you about how they are structured and how they come from a source, the origin of everything, which I call the presence, right? And yet, I want you to always know that everything that you can find in the cosmos, you can find right here in your senses.
So would you say it's a holographic universe? It's like many
said. I don't use the word holograph because it's not a holograph. It's a materially real projection. To Sophia, it's like a dream. The earth is like, to her, like your body is to you in a dream. So here you are now sitting here. We're together in these rooms and you're not dreaming. You're awake and there's your body. There's my body. But in a dream, I have a dream body. So the earth is her dream body. And you are in her dream. You're a character in her dream. The events in your life are she's dreaming them. This is one of the great messages. And this is not a metaphysical theory, my friends. No way. This is something that you can know and experience and prove and verify. That's what the practice of planetary tantra is. It's the upscaling of the Gnostic method. See? So it's huge. What we're talking about is huge, but I always want to bring it back to your, you know, whoever's listening. I mean, how much do you actually care? How much do you care about really knowing? Or do you just want to go along with something that someone tells you? Whether it be the Dalai Lama or Eckhart Tolle or Elon Musk. Do you really want to know in the depths of your own heart and mind these things? You can know that, but only through the path of Gnosis, because it means knowledge. See? I know I sound like a megalomaniac and an arrogant. I'm very comfortable, guilty as charged,
But you also say that you shouldn't follow anyone. I mean, which means that we shouldn't follow you either. I mean, we should only listen to our hearts and go inward and.
No, don't follow me. Why? But I'm a teacher. I'm a teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if I was a scuba diver teacher, and you came on a class with me, and I taught you how to do scuba diving, you know. Very important things, because you could die if you made the wrong mistake. So I teach you about the ocean, the tides, you know, about oxygen, about nitrogen sickness, you know, the bends. And then you don't follow me scuba diving all through the ocean. You go and scuba dive by yourself, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. It's just that the teaching that I offer is unique and paramount. And I know that I come across as really self-important and unique. But it doesn't bother me, because what if it's true? Hmm. What difference does it make if I'm an arrogant, self-important person, as long as what I'm saying is true and it can actually benefit you? See, that's, so I don't care how I look, honestly.
And you build on the Gnostic wisdom. So, I mean, and you've studied that for decades. So you have something to go on there.
But I'm no authority, you know. Mm. The only authority is your own conscience and your ability to know, but really know, not believe, not make believe, not pretend, know.
Mm. And gnosis.
In order for there to be knowledge, there has to be proof. So it's all about proving it.
And you said before that this mind virus is a mutating virus, the archontic virus, and it makes sense when you think about it, because many say that, for instance, enlightenment was an awakening from the dark age of the oppression from the church, but maybe it just was a trick then, because I've suspected for a long time that there is total collusion between the secular and the religious powers that be. And you are saying that this is exactly the case, that was just a mutation of the virus from religion to the belief in science.
Well, that's what happened to science. Science, as it genuinely awoke, science is simply, in a true and sane sense, is simply the exercise of human reasoning.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, yeah, no, but nobody can reject the value of science. That would be totally insane, of course.
It was a good thing that the Enlightenment occurred in the 17th century, and that people like Voltaire and others, you know, violently rejected religion and the clergy. And the Enlightenment, that's the name of that period, was a time when people started to come back to their senses. And then in the 18th century, there were tremendous advances in science. And it was called originally, in its pure form, which largely came from the Germans, was called Naturphilosophie. And Naturphilosophie, if we had it today, we would be living in something like a more utopian world, a much better world in our symbiosis with nature. But that science also got hijacked and perverted eventually, you see? So today, when you have Einstein, complete crap, you know, Einstein, quantum physics, atomic physics, relativity theory, string, this is all garbage. This is not science. This is not science at all. This is an example of how science was taken away from reason, taken out of the realm of the senses, and spun into a mind game, which goes nowhere. Nothing has ever been done through the knowledge of quantum mechanics or relativity theory. Nothing. Nothing has ever been invented based on those scientific theories that is of any use whatsoever. You see? So we have seen for the last 250 years the archontic perversion of science as well. It's a parasitical virus, my friend. Do you get that? It's parasite, and like a parasite, it spreads into culture. We have it in culture now. You know, we have it in the TRANS movements. Mm. you have the archonic virus. One thing that the archons hate is the gender binary. They hate it.
Every species has a niche on this planet, at least we think that. And I think you write that in your book as well.
Yeah.
The question then, it begs the question, what's the niche of the human species? I have a hard time realizing, finding a particular niche for the human race, because it seems as we are unique in that way, that we are different from the other animals, if we are even to be called an animal, because there's no niche, there's no specific place for. What would that be? We have cousins among the primates, and they have niches. They haven't changed in 12 million years. But what's our niche?
It's culture.
Culture. Okay.
Now you can't say that giraffes don't have culture, or elephants have culture, right? Elephants have funerals, they bury dead elephants, they weep, ants have culture, monarch butterflies, snakes. But Sophia and Thelete, that's the correct name for your divine parents, designed the human genome in an amazing way, and I've talked about it at length. So this human genome, which is the double helix DNA, is actually encoded with seven talents. And they designed it so that when the human genome, when the seed, the capsule, dropped into a planetary atmosphere like the Earth and developed into our species, that we would have all these skills and talents. And that allows us to create culture to a degree that far exceeds any other animals, but is not necessarily superior. I say we are an exceptional animal. I say we are animals, and I will fight to the teeth anyone who disagrees with me. But we are an exceptional animal because we have been endowed by our aeonic parents with these talents. And so we create culture. Now, it is true that we are also a high predator. We're the highest predator on the planet. So we prey on all other species and even on our own, right? And also, we can adapt. We can live in many different environments, like otters, or, there's a Swedish moose. There was an albino moose that appeared in Sweden.
That's a big story sometimes here in Sweden. Yeah, has been.
Yeah. It arrived there the day that I did, by the way. And my totem animal is a moose, because a moose is the animal of the state of Maine. But anyway, it has its environment. It's not going to live in the Sahara. It's not going to live in Mexico, right? But we can live anywhere. We're adaptive and we create culture. We are a unique animal in that our niche is not entirely determined by the environmental setting, but we ourselves create it. That's what culture is. And that's what makes us really interesting to the divine observers. They're looking in on the experiment, they say, oh, look at how they create culture. They make pots, dishes, they make clothes, they make weapons. Oh, they build these enormous megalithic sites. How in the hell did they ever do that, right? How did they move those stones? Look at them move those stones and fit them together, Look at they create writing, they create alphabets, This is wondrous. It's wondrous that we do this. And were we able to straighten out our act and correct things, correct the interference, we could do it to the end of glory.
Yeah, let's talk about where we're heading then. The advent of artificial intelligence, or archontic intelligence, as you prefer to call it, I guess.
Absolutely.
Will this lead to the ultimate archontic human, or even extinction? And if not, where are we headed? Are there any promising signs in this age of Aquarius, or wherever we are in time?
Yeah, well, we're a long way from the age of Aquarius, but that's another subject. We're in a Piscean age.
Yeah, but shouldn't it have switched over to the Aquarian age by now? Or
no, if you follow the cosmic clock, the ages are defined by the movement of the spring equinox in the constellations. That's the astronomical basis of the ages. You can't argue about it. It's just how they are calculated.
2,160 years since the last...
It's not an average because the constellations are of different lengths. So the Piscean age began in 120...
Yeah, but the constellations aren't really the thing that is having any influence. It's more the sector of the...
No, of the whole. Sector has no influence at all. You got it backwards.
Okay.
The constellations are real.
Yeah, I know they're real, but I mean...
The sectors are not real. They're like sections on a ruler.
Points in space-time.
Yeah, they're points on the ecliptic plane of the Earth.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Let's talk about where we're heading. Are you seeing any promising signs here in this day and age?
Yeah, sure. I am certain that we stand now, I don't like to use this, but those Volk. Do you say that word in Swedish? Volk?
Volk? Woke.
Volk. Not the woke, the no. Volk. V-O-L-K.
V-U-L-K.
No, V-O-L-K. The folk.
Aha. No, we used the letter F for that in Swedish, but it's in German it's V-O-L-K, yeah.
So say it in Swedish.
Folk.
Okay, the folk.
Yeah.
I'm talking about them, right? Who have heart, who have determination, are facing today a great opportunity, unique in all of the life of our species. And that is the opportunity to set a boundary. Okay? Now, I have said in a recent talk, I can't remember, did I say it? I can't remember what I'm talking about most of the time. So I think I said somewhere, yeah, it was with Lucas on Age of Truth. I said, do you know what a shit test is? Do you know what a shit test is?
Not really.
Okay, it's one word, right? S-H-I-T-T-E-S-T, right? So it goes like this. Suppose I meet you just in a cafe and we start to strike it off and sort of have a conversation, right? But I really don't know if I want to continue this conversation with you because I'm not quite sure, you know, if you're intelligent enough or maybe if you have enough money. And so I ask you outrageous questions, which are not really sincere. But I just ask it to get your reaction, right? You know, for instance, if I said to you, we're sitting in a cafe and I said to you, hey, what do you think of the price range of Ukrainian hookers? You know,
that would be an outrageous question, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think $1,000 a night is too much? You know, I could ask you that question. Obviously, I don't mean that, do I? I'm just asking it to get a reaction from you. See, that's what's called a shit test. Okay. The whole hype that you're now hearing about AI, end of humanity, hundreds of YouTube videos every day, it's going to destroy humanity. It's going to change everything. That's a shit test. It's simply there to test you to see how vulnerable you are and how weak you are. Now, there's an anecdote that comes, this will illustrate what I think is the great opportunity of this time. I'll make it as quick as I can. There's an anecdote that comes from Plato, and it comes from the dialogue called the Phaedrus, at the end of the Phaedrus. And Socrates relates this anecdote, and it's called the anecdote of Thamus, T-H-A-M-U-S. So there's this Egyptian king called Thamus. Probably Thutmosis, probably. And Thoth comes to him, Thoth, the god Thoth,
mm-hmm.
God of writing and
Hermes.
And Thoth comes to him, he's very excited, and he says, oh, King Thomas, you won't believe what I've done. He said, I've created this tool, this magnificent tool of technology. which is called writing. And look, you can write it down in these letters, you know, like the letters that are in the code of this computer right here. You can write it all down. And it's going to just change everything. And it's going to be such a boon and a benefit to humanity. And you have to read this, by the way, in the original. It's only like two paragraphs long. And King Thomas says, oh, no, no, no. He says, what you have created is not an aid to memory, but it will destroy memory. This technology that you present as helping human beings with their faculties will actually destroy their faculties. So this is a warning. And then comes the really great part, which is, I think, the primary lesson of our time today. King Thomas says, those who invent and implement and produce this technology are incapable of judging its usefulness. Now take that message to heart. That comes from Plato, from probably a kind of initiated viewpoint. So I tell you today, this is your opportunity to make a difference. Those who are hyping AI, the transhumanists, the code writers, the technocrats, Elon Musk and all of them, those who are threatening you, they're threatening you with it, or they're saying, oh no, it's the best thing that ever happened. They are the least capable of judging how to use it correctly. But who is? You are. And this is what you have to do. You have to draw a line, a boundary. And this test, it is a test. And this test has never faced humanity before. And it's a really good thing that we're facing this test today, because every single sovereign individual who cares can say, no, I don't accept it. I will not allow it. I will not have it forced upon me. And I will find a way to live my life as free as possible from artificial technology. Doesn't mean I'll reject it entirely, you know, but I will put it within strict boundaries. Like, look at what we're doing here right now. So we're using AI. Am I a hypocrite because I'm advising people? Not at all. It's just a fucking telephone, man. It's a telephone with a screen. Years ago, we would have conducted this interview on the telephone. So, yeah, I use it to teach. I use it for my school. And then I draw a boundary. Do not live on social media. Do not have an iPhone. Do not take my own picture 1,000 times a day. Do not rely on ChatGPT to learn for me. See, if you go to ChatGPT and you ask it a question, then you forego the learning process. You don't go through the learning process. You allow the AI bot to learn for you. You're surrendering your own faculties. This is what Thomas warned us about. So we stand at a frontier, which is a tremendous opportunity to take a stand against transhumanism and technocracy. That's what it's all about. And claim back a natural way of living. Do not live in social media. It's not a life. The life in the virtual is not a life. What you're seeing here, this is not John Lash alive. You're not seeing him alive. You'd have to be here with me. You could stand it to see me alive, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to be in Spain and sit by a table together with you.
Well, don't you know the difference? I mean, what is the difference? Virtual is the archonic medium. They are masters of virtual reality, virtual simulation. Do not go live in the virtual. The choice to live in the virtual or the natural is the choice of Sophia's correction. That's it. It's simple. Common sense.
Yeah, it's. I like what you're saying. It's beautiful, but I think also maybe I mean technology is just. You can see it as just a tool. And Gutenberg's printing press was the same thing as the internet has been, and what artificial intelligence might be in the future, but on different levels, I guess. I mean, you could say that the printing press has destroyed our ability to come up with things ourselves and realize things ourselves and go within and find the truth, and instead reading books.
I disagree.
You disagree?
Oh, we're reading books. Yeah. Here's a book you can read.
Yeah. I mean, that's also artificial intelligence in a way.
No, it isn't. This is not virtual, man.
Okay.
It's not virtual. It's not on a screen. What's on a screen is virtual.
Okay.
On a screen is not going to give you the future that is correct for humanity.
But what's the principal difference between Gutenberg's printing press and the computer?
The printing press is a tool for producing physical artifacts, which you can hold and carry with you. You can go and sit under a tree and read a book and learn something. The difference is that you can't go anywhere with the virtual unless you have an electronic screen. And in that screen, there is nothing that you can hold. It's not a physical artifact.
Well, I read your book on a screen, actually. Gotcha.
Yeah, you got me on that one. Right.
Anyway, what you're saying is it makes a lot of sense, and it's you say many wise words. And this world that you're exposing here, that you're telling about in your book and in your teachings, is it's something else. It's something that you won't find in many other places, actually. But it's pretty fascinating stuff. So, John, it's been a fantastic conversation. Very interesting. And very foundation shaking, I guess. Where can people find out more about you and your work if they want to do that?
Well, I don't do social media. That should be obvious by now.
Yeah, that's obvious.
But I do have.
But you do have a website. You mentioned that, I think.
Website, and I have some YouTube channels, but I'm not really very inclined to do any much more on my YouTube channels. But anyway, the first place I would advise you to go is Sophianic Myth, one word, Sophianic Myth. And that will bring up a 4.5-minute video montage with a voiceover that explains the Sophianic Myth. That's where you begin. Apart from that, there's my YouTube channel, John Lamb Lash, which has a lot on it. For instance, there's a 13-part course on comparative mythology. Free. So if you would like to know, I'm a comparative mythologist. If you'd like to know how I work, you can go take that course. And then principally, there is my school, Nemeta, NEMETA.org. And that's where I present the work based on my intention to restore the humanities. That's my goal. The Gnostic teachers of the past taught the humanities. They taught literacy, art, music. They taught culture, the richness of human culture. And that is the purpose of Nemeta, my school. And that's it. And I don't do anything else on social media.
Hmm. John Lamb Lash, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. And thank you for spreading all your groundbreaking insights and knowledge.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been a good ride, full of thrills. And if some of the listeners can draw some insight, I would be happy that they can. That's all I can say.